This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
When every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good morning. It is 8:03. This is KBOO in Portland. And that was Chumbawamba, one of our favorite, sadly no more, anarchist punk bands. I'm Lynn. I'm here with my lovely co-host.
Good morning.
Ani. And this is Positively Revolting, the show where we strive to keep tough topics in the conversation in a positive yet revolting kind of way. Our guest this morning, we're talking about the conversation this morning is Roe v. Wade 40 years later. Our guest this morning has received a BA from the University of Michigan in creative writing and literature, a master's degree from Emerson College in publishing, and after years in the editorial world, discovered her latent reproductive activist self. Her first book, which is going to come out called The Generation Roe, A Study of the Past, Current, and Future State of the Pro-Choice Movement in America, will be available in March, but we have Sarah with us live by phone this morning. Good morning, Sarah Erdrich.
Good morning.
Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, you are.
Okay, those CHs can go either way.
Yeah, it can be tricky, but no, you're doing fine.
Okay, thanks. Well, Sarah, this is 40 years later. Oh, my gosh. You know, Sarah Weddington, who was the attorney that took this case to the Supreme Court, was in town for a Planned Parenthood benefit this week, and she was saying it was controversial. She thought, it was going to be controversial for a little while, but by and large, the American public at the time in the 70s said about Roe v. Wade, well, of course, and just moved on. And she thought that's what would happen, but 40 years later, it's still front page news. And you had an article that I liked for Feminists for Choice called 40 Years Later, What the Roe, where you say 40 years ago, Roe v. Wade made abortion legal. It gave women the right to terminate a pregnancy that could not and would not exist without them. It did nothing to convince men or women that women were entitled to this right. It had no way of legislating the belief that a woman's life is of equal or greater value than the fetus growing inside her. What is one law against a couple millennia's worth of sexist dogma? And I ask you that question. What is one law against that large amount of? And I love how you put that, because that is to seem to be the core of the issue.
Well, thank you for the compliment, but actually that was an article I edited. Another one of our contributors wrote it.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, although I'd greatly agree with the sentiment.
All right, we'll start there then.
I think that, yeah, Roe really, a lot of people at the time thought, this is it. The question's been settled, and we can all move on now. And
I was alive then. I did.
Yeah.
I remember it well.
And I think there was an article, I think Linda Greenhouse had an op-ed in the New York Times earlier this week, quoting one of the justices who had, Potter Stewart, who had ruled on Roe v. Wade, and when he saw the protesters massing several years later on the anniversary, he was taken aback because he thought it was, you know, we already decided this. Why are we still talking about it? But it really, you know, abortion, it goes to so many, it gets complicated very quickly. And a lot of people, it hits in moral, you know, a lot of what people hold as their moral beliefs and religious beliefs and these ideas that are so ingrained in our society about women's roles and women's rights. So it really does butt up against a lot of these very deeply held personal beliefs that a lot of people want to kind of make their beliefs be the ones that are known and feel that there's are the right way to think. So it really gets, like I said, it gets complicated very quickly.
And good morning, Sarah. This is Ani. In my experience, people and their experience, the women with their experience around abortion, it's one of those issues. And again, this is, I think, one of the things that Roe was very clear about. It's no one's business but a woman and her doctor. It is a guaranteed right to privacy between a woman and her doctor seeking a woman seeking health care about reproductive care, and how, you know, really when we think about we're going to the doctor, how that is a private act. So women have kept these stories to themselves often, and I think that that allows us to compartmentalize, to say, I don't believe in the right to abortion, except in my particular circumstances, and that there has been a tendency over the years for many women to sort of see themselves as exceptional. And I come to this as somebody who had worked for 4 years at a feminist women's health center as a lay health worker. And I've talked to scores of women who are facing this choice, who've made this choice, to hear them say, well, you know, I don't believe in abortion. I don't believe that this should be easy to attain, but I know in my own life, I tried, you know, to use other methods of contraceptives. I've right. been responsible. My circumstances are exceptional. My circumstances are different. Other women, they aren't so careful. They shouldn't have this right. And this is something that has confounded me, you know, for a few decades. And I do remember Deirdre English and Barbara Ehrenreich noting this in an early pamphlet that they had put out in the early 80s about how in this way we justify, women justify their own exceptions to accessing abortion, but still in conservative groups are able to organize and say, no, this shouldn't be for everyone. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think that definitely is a phenomenon that I've seen a lot, both personally and people that I interviewed for the book had also commented about. And I think that gets to that a lot of women feel that there should be a sense of shame around abortion, that women who, and a lot of women who have abortions feel relief. You know, there's no one right way to feel
right
after having an abortion. It's a very personal choice, and people feel the whole range of emotions following it, and that's okay. But there seems to be this very strong social and cultural pressure that you should feel sadness around an abortion. There is one right way to feel. And I think part of why women are saying, well, it was okay for me because I put a lot of thought into it. I had reason X, Y, and Z for choosing it. But that doesn't mean I want other, that doesn't mean other women make the same deliberations I did. You know, there's mm-hmm. this kind of sense of, I know my reasons are right. I don't know if their reasons are right, so I can't support it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very damaging for both for the woman herself who thinks that, because that's a very limiting way to look, but it's also very damaging for women as a whole, that if one person can access this right, it should be accessible for all people, not just those who feel like they have the right reasons to have an abortion.
And certainly in this 40-year span, you know, I was working at the clinics in the late 80s through the early 90s. And at that time, you know, we were facing firebombings. My day job included me getting to the clinic a half hour before anyone else and looking for bombs. You know, it's an interesting way to start your work day.
And no extra pay for that, I'm sure. No hazard pay.
Not really, no. But I shouldn't say before anyone else, because it was always the buddy system. There was always two of us checking for bombs. You know, and the clinic I worked at actually was sent a letter bomb that would have leveled the block had they not caught it. You know, so the idea of the whole meme of the right to life in that kind of setting, there's so many contradictions in that I could spin off for the next 3 hours and we won't talk about anything else. But to look at, even in that environment, which was pretty heated 20 years ago, I don't believe that we... You know, we always thought, Roe could be eroded, that we have to be careful, we have to be vigilant. But certainly in the last 20 years, we have seen a lot of erosion of Roe. And if we could talk about, you know, as I was trying to promote the show and saying, you know, what's happened in the last 40 years, we've had this right. I had to stop myself from saying, spoiler alert, we've lost a lot of it. But let's just jump to that chase. Let's look at the state of abortion rights and the right to choose termination of pregnancy and where that sits now compared to the 40 years ago.
It's interesting because you mentioned kind of looking over the past both 40 and 20 years. And I think a lot of the current restrictions that we're seeing do date from about 20 years ago with the Casey ruling on the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And that basically said that the government or the state cannot put an undue burden on a woman mm-hmm. who seeks an abortion. But it left the definition of undue burden very vague. And so so the people often who are deciding what an undue burden is are not the women themselves who are trying to get an abortion, and they're not the physicians or the clinic staffers who are working helping these women get abortions. They're politicians and legislators who are making these determinations. And I think that's why you have seen such an increase over the past 20 years, and particularly over the past few years, of these mandatory ultrasound bills and mandatory waiting periods and states being given the right to tell doctors, here's what you have to say to the woman in your mandatory counseling, which often is very biased and scientifically incorrect information.
And a huge undue burden.
And that, yes, that is very much a burden on both on the physician and the woman.
Yeah. Which seems to contradict what Roe v. Wade was about.
It does, and I think that's why, as important as Roe v. Wade is, and as significant as that a landmark as that ruling is, Casey also, you know, is very significant in that it's one of the more direct strikes against the protections enshrined in Roe. You know, what Casey did was basically say was give the states a lot more power than Roe initially allowed them to have in determining when a woman could get an abortion and how easy that could be for her to access.
There's the Casey decision. There's also the Webster decision that was very harmful in the, gosh, early 90s now, I think. And there are really several decisions looking at, well, what is undue burden, making these different, consent talks and explanatory discussions with your physician where they are, in fact, scripted and the physician doesn't have their full rights to practice medicine in the way they see. Also, the erosion of privacy around minors, around women who are less than 18, younger than 18, suddenly needing parental consent. In you know, cases, can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, in those, it's interesting. A lot when you see polls that come out around, you know, American support for abortion, and I know there's been several that came out just this week that showed that support for Roe v. Wade and for abortion rights were at all-time highs, which is very encouraging. But then you break the numbers down a little bit, and you do see that there is still a great deal of support for things such as parental notification and parental consent laws. And, a lot, you know, on their face, those laws, a lot of people can look at them and say, well, yes, a parent should be involved in their, you know, in their teenage daughter's decisions. And that's the ideal, is that a child or a teenager could go and talk to her parents and say, I'm pregnant and I need help deciding what to do. But a lot of these laws really overlook the fact that if a teenager can't tell her parents she's pregnant, she has a pretty good reason for it. It's not that she's worried about getting grounded or, you know, some sort of right. punishment like that. It's that she's worried about getting kicked out of her house or she's worried about abuse. You know, there are very right. real reasons. And those laws also overlook the reality of a lot of families, which is that it's not always possible for a teenager to go to her parents if she's being raised by another relative, for example, or if she's in the foster care system, or mm-hmm. there are all these different permutations that of family that these laws overlook, and they really put the onus on the teenage girl to work around them instead of what the law should be doing, which is supporting the girl and making her best decision. And I know in a lot of states they do allow for a judicial bypass by which a teenager can go before a judge mm-hmm. and ideally get his or her approval, essentially permission mm-hmm. to have an abortion. But I mean, I know when I was a teenager, I would not have had the wherewithal to get that process going. And I think for a lot of teenagers, it's very difficult to navigate the court system often by themselves.
That seems daunting.
In a timely process.
Extremely.
It seems daunting for an adult to navigate the court system in a timely way, you know, alone, you know, a young woman who's 16, 17, you know, 14 years of age and needing to, you know, who's already in a crisis and under stress.
And wants a medical procedure.
Indeed.
You know, I had never seen Doe versus Bolton until I started researching today. And that seems like that should be covering some of those things, which was a ruling in 1971. Are you you're familiar with that, I would presume?
I am. Yeah. Yes, well, Doe v. Bolton is interesting. It was actually decided by the court. The opinion was released on the same day as Roe v. Wade. And in a way, the opinions were meant to be read together in that they both addressed abortion, reproductive rights. Doe v. Bolton focused around a Georgia law that initially came before the court in 1971 and then also greatly restricted when women in the states could have an abortion done. At the time, Georgia said that only state residents could have abortions, and only in the cases of rape, severe fetal deformity, or if the life of the woman was in danger. And the Supreme Court's ruling was interesting in that not only did they say that those conditions violated the 14th Amendment, and they violated the residency requirement, violated another part of the Constitution. But the court said that, in Doe v. Bolton, that these impositions that the state made were unconstitutional against a woman's health, not just her physical health, but her mental health as well. And that's very significant because even today, the idea that pregnancy can adversely affect a woman's mental health is very controversial. So for the court to say that in 1973 was really groundbreaking. Mm-hmm.
Quite. I want to remind people, you are listening to Positively Revolting. We are a talk radio program every Friday morning on KABU, your community radio station. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we are here every Friday at 8 o'clock with you. You can, in fact, stay in touch with Positively Revolting throughout the week by liking our Facebook fan page. You can find us on Facebook /Positively Revolting. You can also email us on our Gmail account, positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. And we also, of course, are welcoming your calls, your comments, your questions now live in the studio. Interact with us, 503-231-8187. And we have Karen on the line. Good morning, Karen. Good morning, Karen. Perhaps we don't have Karen on the line. We'll have the engineer working with that for just another moment.
Meanwhile, we do have Sarah Erdrich on the as our guest this morning. She is has a book that is coming out next month called Generation Row. And do you have talks, say, perhaps coming up in the Portland area where you're going to be promoting your book or that you'd like to talk about?
Well, unfortunately, nothing scheduled in Portland yet, although I'm hoping that will change because I've never been to Portland, but I've always wanted to come visit.
Oh, everyone does now.
Well, yeah. I will be giving readings primarily on the East Coast in New York and Philadelphia. Also, Los Angeles and San Francisco are my currently scheduled West Coast stops. And I'll even have the chance to visit the South and go down to Austin, Texas to promote the book, which I'm very much looking forward to because abortion in Texas is always an interesting topic.
Yes, I would imagine so. I want to we have three different testimonials that were sent to us by listeners. Mm-hmm. excuse me, as I put out the call earlier this week. And I want to go ahead and share the first one of those now. So our listener writes, I've been almost in, this is actually a piece that she worked out as a performance piece for an open mic a while back. So you can see by the first paragraph, it's a little dated. It talks about the murder of Dr. George Tiller. So that's where it starts. I have been almost incoherently angry about the shooting of Dr. Tiller. So I thought I'd tell you what it was like to have a somewhat legal abortion in Oregon in 1970. This was 3 years before Roe v. Wade and 3 years after an Oregon law passed permitting abortion due to rape, incest, mental, or physical problems. I was lucky because a friend of mine who had had an abortion shortly before I did showed me the way. The only way she could get hers was to spend a week in a county mental hospital, which at that time was up at OHSU. I was 19. I was ignorant of many things. I had not been taught by anybody what was going on, and the only thing I knew was passion. Of course, any education at that time was abstinence only. Get married. Abstinence only equals ignorance only. I remember my mother giving me a book with rabbits, doing it. What does that mean? I was shy and depressed, and I had low self-esteem. I'd moved out 5 months before that. I broke up with my boyfriend. We got back together. We began living together. We had a minimum wage job lifestyle. Sometimes we used birth control, sometimes not. I was in denial about being pregnant. I finally went to Outside In, which still exists and still does good work. I remember getting the phone call with the results at the Agora Coffee House at PSU's Canoña House in the basement. They told me and I said, what am I going to do? I don't want this baby. I don't want to do this. And I was totally enfolded by people who were willing to, if not break the law, stretch the law. I had to have an affidavit by three doctors saying that I was not mentally fit to have a child. I never saw these doctors. They were just somewhere signing papers for us. I had to go to the assistant district attorney along with my boyfriend because I was considered a minor, even though it was legal for me to live by myself outside of my parents' home. Again, the writer was 19. I had to talk to the assistant DA, who later became a DA, and then the judge. And I had to become a ward of the court for a day, the day of the procedure. I remember telling him, I remember him telling us to quit playing house. I had a stack of legal documents half an inch thick. I kept them for a long time. I finally threw them out. I kind of wish I hadn't now. So outside in made all the arrangements. There were no clinics at that time. You had to have everything go through a hospital. My mother found out from my soon-to-be former best friend and showed up on my doorstep pleading and screaming. I said no. This was the first time I stood up to her deliberately. Before, I'd always snuck around standing up to her. Come home, get married, she said. No, I won't. And if you try to force me, if you try to get in the way, I'll commit suicide. Because basically, I had already raised her kids while she was off doing other stuff, and I had had enough of kids. My boyfriend, John, borrowed money from his friends. It was about a month's pay. I had total anesthetic. The only thing I remember about it, an angry nurse tried to jab an IV in my hand, and another nurse chewed her out. So I'm grateful to all these people I have never met, and I still have no remorse. I am glad. I hope that this is being taped. I don't care who hears it. It's time for this garbage to stop. I'm really tired of being peaceful about this garbage. I'm really tired of everyone trying to play nice with these jerks. So bring it on. Bring it on. Slightly edited for FCC regulations. But that is the first of three vignettes this morning. And we thank everyone who called to share those. I do believe, no, okay. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We've had a little bit of an issue with our studio telephone. So if you
can also send a question to positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. And we have lines are open there. We have internet, so that's working.
Indeed. And likely the phone line is too. So yeah. Just go ahead, give it another try. And we appreciate your patience.
So, I find, Sarah, I find in conversations with people about abortion, there is this strange thing. Well, if they just put, I was having a conversation with somebody the other, if they just put more money into birth control, then, and I'm like, no, that is not the point. The point is that seems to be missed because of the hysteria and political rhetoric around this is that it's a medical procedure, and it's something that should be safe and available for women to use. That this huge folks that want I always say save the fetus to hell with the woman. That whole same question that I talked about in that first piece about how we are going to like move past this culturally. Do you have thoughts about that sort of issue?
I think that's a good question. It's a big question. I'm not sure I have the entire answer, but I always think about one of the activists who I interviewed for my book. We were talking about this issue about why, you know, what is it going to take to get the conversation to a more useful place instead of this constant abortion's horrible, abortion's wrong. Like, what is it going to take to move the needle? And she said that she thinks that one thing that's missing in the conversation is the idea of empathy. She said part of that's on the pro-choice movement for not doing a better job at putting forth women's stories and family stories and the stories of anyone who has made this choice or has had their life shaped by this choice in a positive way. That people, the idea of, you can't judge someone else, and you can't ever know the circumstances of their lives and what's the decision. So who are you to make a decision for a stranger? And I think that that is really an effective part of this conversation, because when you speak to people on a one-on-one level about choice and about abortion, you're really able to break down a lot of misconceptions and stereotypes that still exist around this. I remember several years ago, I had a conversation with a complete stranger on an airplane. He asked me what I did for my job, and I mentioned I was writing this book, and that led into a conversation about abortion. And he had so, and he was a very nice guy, very intelligent, but he had so many misconceptions about what an abortion entailed. He really seemed to think that anyone could just walk into a clinic, no notice, and go ahead and get an abortion done. And he was really taken aback when I explained, no, this is
and then go out to lunch.
That is, you know, that a lot of people put thought into just because they have to, because it's so expensive, you know, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when you can get down to that level of having these talks, they don't have to be adversarial or confrontational. They can be very rewarding for both sides.
There is something that is just telling the truth about abortion that is very powerful, and I find very effective in talking to people like you're saying now. I think that having women share our stories about our experiences with abortion, and not just abortion, but actually, you know, this was a hugely important part of the struggle to me. It's what I'm looking for is actual reproductive freedom of choice, right? So that we not only have access guaranteed to safe, legal, affordable, accessible abortions. Access to accessible abortions, it's a little redundant, but you know, you get my point. I'm pretty firm on the accessibility there. But also looking at a full range of other options so that if a woman decided that, in fact, she would like to raise a child but does not feel that she has the economic support to do so, you know, how can we as a society, you know, actually support all choices? You know, I find it insane that the same people, by and large, the forced birthers of the crowd, I really hate the phrase pro-choice because, again, they kill doctors. They don't give a hoot about women or the kids after they're born, really. You know, it's just the fetus. They're pro-fetus. You know, that if these folks would concentrate on actually having affordable daycare, actually having quality daycare, actually working on economic justice issues so that minimum wage can actually support a single parent with child. These sorts of issues play into reproductive choices and reproductive freedoms to me. And I don't understand why really all sides don't look more at a bigger picture of what reproductive choice is.
I think that's a very good point, and I do. That was something that I was researching when I was writing Generation Row, was both how both sides, both the pro-choice and the anti-choice side, have dealt with these, with looking at the bigger picture. And I think for their part, I think there's a lot that the pro-choice movement does really well, but I don't think that they've been very effective at looking at the fact that, although, you know, when women are pregnant, that there is a fetus involved. I mean, on the flip side, I think that the anti-choice side has focused way too much on the fetus. So
right.
I think that I'm not saying they should put that front and center, but I think the pro-choice side can often be kind of scared to discuss, you know, you are pregnant. This and in a lot of cases when women have abortions, it is for reasons of health, or either the woman's or the fetus's. So mm-hmm. it's not necessarily, so in a lot of cases, it is a wanted pregnancy that has to be terminated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the pro-choice side would do well to share, to look at those stories and make sure that those women's voices are heard as well, that this is a complicated issue and that, there, again, that there's no one way to look at it, because I think promoting more and letting more women's voices be heard definitely puts forth the idea to the general public that abortion is a complicated subject and one that no one can judge for someone else.
Now, right, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think on the flip side, I think why the anti-choice movement has focused so much on the fetus to the exclusion of the woman and the exclusion of any other of the realities of having a child is because it's very easy to focus on a fetus. You know, that's all potential, that's all in the future. And looking at the reality of women's lives, that can be really complicated and really messy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that rather than do that, they just look at the fetus and say, well, this is hope, this is the future, let's support that. And that's a very, you know, in a way, that's a very appealing way to think, because it's very simplistic. So I think that's why they've had such success.
Well, and I think people have a lot of issues, their own little childhood issues, or if you had an abortion and you have some misgivings about it afterwards, it seems like it would be more productive to work through those feelings rather than try to ban it for other people. And then there is the issue of women having control over their own bodies that seems to be very scary for some folks.
Oh, very much. And, it's interesting that we're here in the 21st century and still there are so many people who don't like the idea that women can make these decisions autonomously.
Right.
And honestly, I'm not sure how much luck we'll have getting that mindset to change, because if you're still thinking that, I don't really know what more evidence,
right,
to say to you at that point. But I think that there is, a lot to be said for appreciating the different reasons that women have abortion. And again, going back to the idea of empathy, of having some empathy for the fact that maybe you wouldn't do the same thing in that situation, but it's not your situation.
But it's not your situation, exactly so.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and work a phone guest in here. We have Randy on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've known a lot of pro-lifers. Gosh, I think they're just outstanding, compassionate citizens that just really have a grasp of all the problems. You said it's complicated. I totally agree. But in this discussion, I haven't heard just acknowledgement head on what abortion is. What is abortion?
Abortion is, in fact, the chosen, a therapeutic abortion is the chosen end to a pregnancy prior to term. That's what it is. Again, I got to say, I come from the position that a woman is not an incubator. And that's where I stand, because a woman needs right to control her body, knows her circumstances better than anyone else, better than the rest of society. So I'm pretty well seated in that.
I
thank you for your call. I have a feeling that you're trying to get to, but what about the baby? Is that where you're going?
Is that unfair?
It's not really a part of this discussion. It's not. But thanks very much for your call, Randy.
Thanks.
I mean, we're looking at, in fact, the woman's right over again to control her body.
And her right to privacy.
To decide her circumstances that she knows better than anyone else, and to actually discuss a medical procedure with her physician without interference of the state. That's what we're talking about. And back in my time working at the abortion clinic, I got to say, there's about 13 healthcare workers, and half of us, slightly under half, I think there was about five of us, that were adopted. I'm an adoptee. And we started talking about that one day, and none of us were thinking, oh, I wish my biological mom had an abortion. Like, that's not where we went. But what we, I think, had an innate understanding of was that these choices are complicated. And that we hear the refrain that, if you find yourself with a pregnancy that for some reason you do not feel comfortable carrying to term or to raise a child, that your option, your compassionate option is adoption. It's not that simple, and it's certainly not that simple for the adoptees involved as we grow, as we try to find our place in the world and our families.
And full-term pregnancy is not easy on women's bodies. That is a risk.
There is that. In fact, abortion is medically safer than taking contraceptive pills for a couple of years. So, gotta say, there's all of those issues involved, and this is just not simple. And again, essentially, it is a choice, a medical decision made between a woman and her doctor, as it needs to be. Sarah, any comments?
I couldn't agree more with all that you just said. And I think that, I think personally this is something that for me was really brought home when I was pregnant last year. And it really, I've read a lot of women saying, once after I was pregnant, I could never choose abortion. I could, you know, it kind of solidified their anti-choice beliefs. But for me, and I think for an equal number of women, if not more, it really solidified my pro-choice belief that this really is a decision that is best made by the person who is pregnant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was very fortunate in that I had a relatively easy pregnancy. We did not, you know, we had the standard test done because my husband and I wanted this information. And very early on in my pregnancy, I talked to my doctor and I said, just so you know, very pro-choice, very much also very aware of my limitations and what I can handle. And so, you know, depending on how this pregnancy progresses, if a termination, because you never know. You mm-hmm. never know what might develop. And I just wanted to make sure my physician and I were on the same page as to if any sort of fetal deformity or anything that could be incompatible with life was discovered, I wanted to know what her position would be.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've talked to far too many women who have had to deal with a late-term termination
mm-hmm.
because of an abnormality that was discovered mm-hmm. in the second or third trimester.
Yeah.
And, you know, going through all that, and like I said, we were very lucky, and I'm very grateful, but that really, for me, just brought home how complicated these choices are and how glad I am that I had the right
mm-hmm.
to decide when to become pregnant, and that I also had the right to decide what to do in my pregnancy. And I think that's not a right that, unfortunately, that's a right that not every woman in this country has, and that's a real shame.
And it's especially burdensome, and to me, it flies in the face of having this right when you live in a state with one or two abortion providers. And that is a reality for women living in areas other than Oregon. You know, I can't remember the states now, but I know 20 years ago, I believe there was one abortion provider in North Dakota. I don't know if
well,
that's
changed.
Well,
and are there only four late-term abortion providers? I was hearing about the documentary that's out about Tiller. That was at the Sundance Film Festival, and I was totally unaware that that was sort of it for the country.
Yes.
There are very few, very, very few providers that will go late term, which are generally defined as after about 24 weeks of pregnancy. I interviewed one of those providers for my book, Dr. Leroy Carhart, and he serves both patients in Nebraska and also in Maryland, because there aren't any other providers. I mean, he does this tremendous work, and he's very staunch in his beliefs. And fortunately, there are other providers like him out there, but definitely nowhere near enough. And to what you're saying about states that are underserved, I don't know the exact number for North Dakota, but I know one other clinic that's been in the news recently is in Mississippi, mm-hmm. where there is only one abortion clinic in the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
And the state, the governor, and anti-choice politicians in Mississippi are trying very, very hard to close that center down
mm-hmm.
and leave the state without any abortion clinics whatsoever.
Let me go ahead and get to the second of the vignettes. We have only 15 minutes left. I want to remind people that we are talking with Sarah Erdrich. She is the author of Generation Row, coming out next month from Seven Stories Press. I'm Ani. I'm here with Lynn. And we are contactable throughout the week by email. You can always email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, where we are Positively Revolting, and like our page, stay in the conversation all week long. Let me go ahead and add this second vignette to the mix. I was in graduate school studying for qualifying exams when my out-of-town boyfriend came to visit for Thanksgiving. We used a diaphragm, but it failed. I was stressed, as people are in PhD programs. I wasn't eating right, hardly sleeping, so I didn't realize I was pregnant until I was almost 2 months along. When I told the boyfriend, he struggled with what to say and almost managed to say, "Marry me," before giving up and offering to pay for half an abortion. I never really considered keeping the baby. He didn't want it, and I was halfway through a graduate program that was so intense and competitive that one of the students a year ahead of me died of pneumonia 2 weeks after taking her qualifying exams. Even the woman professors in my own program mostly felt that having children would have been too much of a distraction from their scholarly work. Of course, the men all had children, but they could rely on wives to take care of their kids. Nobody would have thought that it was possible to continue the program pregnant or with a child. Without the program, I had no money, no job, and no health insurance. For me, the worst part was keeping silent about being pregnant, even while I was nauseated and tired and trying to keep up with my work. I remember throwing up while I was walking to class, struggling to do dishes, struggling to wake up to teach my TA sections, feeling angry and feeling I had to hide something that was affecting me so much that wasn't my fault. My housemates knew, and they helped some. I was pregnant longer than I needed to be because of a male OBGYN at the student health clinic who misled me about having to wait, I think in the hope that I would keep the baby. I only saw him once for a few minutes, and I didn't realize it at the time, but now I think it's the truth when I look back at it. By the time I did get to the abortion clinic, I was almost over the first trimester. The abortion itself was expensive. It was unpleasant, nasty, painful, in a big concrete warehouse place outside of town. My boyfriend flew back to see me through it, and a few months later we broke up. I was glad to have it over with. I was glad to have my body back. I passed my qualifiers in the spring. So that's the second of the three vignettes, and I believe that we have another caller.
We do.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning.
Thank you. Very valuable program you're having. I missed the first part of your program. Wasn't there a fairly well-publicized case over in Ireland where a woman died because she couldn't get an abortion? She couldn't, for some reason, couldn't go over to England where most...
There are cases like this all over the world and actually in our country as well. So I'm not sure the specific case you're talking about. That does ring a bell, but I don't have those specifics in front of me. Sarah, do you know?
Yeah.
Yes, you're discussing the death of Savita, I'm going to mispronounce her last name, but Jalapa Navar, last October. She is a young woman who was admitted to University Hospital Galway, and I'm looking up the exact information, she was about 17 weeks pregnant, and she, even though she was essentially miscarrying, I believe, when she was admitted into the hospital, but even though she and her husband asked for an abortion to be done, the hospital refused because allegedly they said that they were a Catholic country, and mm-hmm. so they couldn't perform the abortion. And about a week after she was admitted, Savita died as a result of the illness. I believe the official cause of death was septicemia, which led to multiple organ failure.
Yeah, yeah, where was I going with this? I missed the first part of the program. I mean, to say it's legal and rare is on the spot on, but it kind of glib and simplistic. I guess it's also simplistic to say, but it needs to be said. Even if you get abortion abolished, abortion is still going to happen at the hands of unqualified people.
Well, that women do actually control their bodies, and that this has happened before abortion was legal and accessible, and it will continue to happen. So you're right that what we're talking about is the accessibility to a safe, medically licensed procedure.
And you know, as far as the anti-choice people are going, this is another simplistic point, but. Where are they on family planning and reducing the need for unwanted pregnancies in the first place? And I'll get off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your call, Tom. Sarah, any comment or?
Well, I think you raise a very good point that if you know that a lot of anti-choice activists and supporters. They're not exactly in favor of birth control, in favor of sex education being taught in the schools.
They're
not, that they very much have a viewpoint of.
It's all about austerity.
Yeah.
it's the abstinence only plan.
The ultimate austerity.
There's a new bill that is maddening, to say the least, that I just started finding out about yesterday. In New Mexico, there's a bill now calling post-rape abortion evidence tampering.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've had a chance to check this out. This is
Yes.
Okay. Critics claiming that I'm so apoplectic, I can't actually even read the headline. This is from USA Today yesterday. So I guess I should say it's from USA yesterday. Critics claim sexual assault victims would be criminals or forced to carry unwanted pregnancies. Lawmakers say that it's aimed at the attackers. A New Mexico lawmaker has drawn fire for proposing legislation to classify an abortion after sexual assault as tampering with evidence. Do you want to comment on that, Sarah?
Well, I think it's completely outrageous. I think that this is perhaps a more egregious example of a bill that purports to be for the well-being of women, and when absolutely nothing could be further from the truth. To say that this bill is aimed at, I believe that the explanation was that, you know, if someone is a victim of rape, but then they're coerced by the rapist and gain an abortion, that a bill like this would protect them. Where I failed to see the logic in that. It seems like,
yes,
this is just one more way to punish women and to say, oh, you know, we're going to make you carry a pregnancy that's a result of a horrible traumatic situation. We're going to make you carry the pregnancy to term. And that's just ridiculous.
Or my favorite one about pregnant women who lose babies face criminal charges in Mississippi and Alabama. I think that was this summer that happened.
Yes. Yeah, it's the idea of that the woman's rights should be secondary to the rights of a fetus. And this is, it's ridiculous, and it's such a perverse way of looking at the world and looking at women that I'm at a loss to explain, you know, how that mentality comes about and why people think this actually makes sense.
Well, and certainly, I mean, it's basically the criminalization of pregnancy. I mean, we've seen forced hospitalizations for women who may have issues with blood sugar, gestational diabetes, who suddenly find themselves
It's science fiction to me. It's like Margaret
to a hospital,
yeah, Margaret Atwood,
for their own good or for the good of the fetus. And again, the woman, I said it briefly and in passing earlier. Women are being treated as incubators, and in that scenario, that's not okay with me, and it really should not be okay with anyone who cares deeply about our civil rights, our human rights, and in fact, women being taken seriously as, say, you know, full people, because we've advanced past that whole we're not right. We aren't talking about women not actually being people or soulless. We're not actually in the days of Augustine anymore, right? That was years ago. So we have only 7 minutes left. I'm sorry, I have no rant control today. This is a topic that I just I get pretty fired up
about.
Should
we take one more call?
I'm very happy to have you with us this morning, Sarah Erdrich, author of soon-to-be-released Generation Roe, looking at the last 40 years of reproductive rights.
And the future.
And the future thereof. Also want to remind folks, you can connect with us on Facebook, Positively Revolting, or email us, positivelyrevolting@ gmail.com. I'm Ani. I'm here with Lynn. I've got one more vignette I want to get through that has a somewhat different tone than the others. And I wanted to share this one from Missy, who said I can use her first name. So this is from Missy. My abortion was fantastic. I wouldn't change a thing. It also gave me a greater insight into how abortions can lead to remorse, to shame, sadness, anger, or hardship for many. Some of the basics that helped me, that helped this be a wonderful experience for me were a supportive partner. He asked what I wanted to do when we found out I was pregnant. He fully supported that, what to me was the best and only reasonable option. He asked about my feelings. He shared his with me. And he followed my lead. Free and easy access to abortion. Back then, in 1999, the Oregon Health Plan covered your abortion if you were poor. It covered it completely and quickly. The only one awkward part was that they asked to know who the father was in an effort to pursue compensation, I assume. I awkwardly claimed that I had no idea who the male involved was. I was lucky enough to live in a city where I had more than one alternative for pregnancy termination. Without hesitation, I went to the now defunct facility that had been formerly called the Feminist Women's Health Center. Their practitioners were professional, respectful, and kind. They didn't use general anesthesia, which was huge for me. General anesthesia can take days to recover from. The nurse practitioner didn't blink when I asked her for a photocopy of my ultrasound. She didn't question my feelings or look at me oddly. A supportive community. My friends were understanding, non-judgmental, and they looked after my health. A dear friend went to the clinic with me and helped me and held my hand through this about 6 drastically painful minutes. Then she helped me pick up my prescriptions and took me home. She checked on me and told me how amazing it was that my body was fertile. She helped me realize that many, many women who have sex with men experience pregnancy, whether it's wanted or unwanted, and that this was actually something to be amazed at and grateful for. I chose not to tell my family. Not everyone has this option. And I did tell my sister some months later. I had the luck to dodge just about anyone who would not be completely supportive of my pregnancy and my abortion. I also had the luxury of not having been raised with a tradition wherein terminating pregnancy is a sin. I had a party. Yes, I had an abortion party. My partner and I dyed eggs as though it were Easter in a symbolic gesture towards fertility. We drank mimosas and ate brunch and made our friends feel a bit put on the spot. After all, what does one bring to an abortion party? A present? In the end, there was only one time that someone tried to shame me for my abortion. This is an aside. I found this part to be really eye-opening. Back to the text. My partner and I went with handmade signs to protest a pro-life rally at PSU. The whole thing had dispersed by the time we arrived, and we went to the women's center on campus to see if there was anything else planned. The two women there greeted us and asked to see our signs. Oh no, they cried. Women don't feel that way. They were freaked out over my I heart my abortion sign. What do you mean? I asked. They asserted, no, women don't like abortions. They regret them. Women only like choices, not abortions. I told them that I was glad that I got pregnant. I was glad to have an abortion and that I wasn't living with regret. These two liberal, quote, feminists, end quote, told me that I should just wait and see, that someday I would be sad about my abortion eventually. Well, it's 2013, and I'm grateful every April that I do not have a now teenager on my hands. Every September, I'm so thankful to my friends who supported me and all the feminists of yore who created abortion clinics that are dwindling by the minute. I heart my abortion for reals. And that's the last of our vignettes of this morning. So again, 3 different women with 3 very, very different reactions to the experience of abortion in their lives, to their own circumstances and what led them to these decisions. And that to me, I mean, is at essence why we have Roe, why we have a right to privacy, to discuss our bodies, our health care, with our doctors, without interference of anyone else. Because we don't need our partner, we don't need our fathers, we don't need Big Daddy the government to decide what's right for ourselves in our lives. We only have 1 minute left, and I want to give Sarah the last chance to wrap up your thoughts for this morning.
I just want to say that I think that last story is fantastic. I'm very glad I've gotten to hear all 3 of those vignettes, but I think that the one from Missy, I was just so happy to hear that story. I think that's a perspective that we don't hear enough, and I'm so happy that she let that be shared with all of us this morning. And I've really enjoyed speaking with y'all and hearing both your thoughts and getting to explore these subjects more. I think that this is a topic that deserves
Thank you, Sarah.
And as much conversation as it can get.
Thank you, Sarah. We are being kicked off the air now. It is time for us to go. Thank you so much, and we'll hopefully talk again.
We'll be in touch. Abortion on demand without apology, because it's our right. It's our bodies. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned.
It is 9 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany, and on the web at kboo.fm. Up next, it's One Land, Many Voices. The previously scheduled guest, Miko Peled, had to cancel this morning. Instead, we'll hear a talk by Jeff Halper, the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. The topic is a single democratic state in Israel-Palestine, the only option Israel and the United States have left us. At 10, hear Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, the Pentagon lifts the ban on women serving in ground combat positions, including elite commando jobs. We'll hear two views on the landmark decision. Also, award-winning poet Martin Espada remembers People's History of the United States author Howard Zinn. At 11, KBOO's Jinka Soderberg speaks with former political prisoner Josh Harper, who spent 3 years in prison with terrorism charges for giving a speech in which he explained how to send faxes of black paper to try to waste toner. Harper is one of the Shack 7, six animal rights activists in the organization Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty USA, who were convicted in 2006 under the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. Thanks, KBOO listeners, and thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now we hear a lecture by Jeff Halper, the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. The topic is a single democratic state in Israel-Palestine, the only option Israel and the United States have left us. He spoke in Portland in September.
When I told my grandmother in Minnesota that I was going to move to Israel, she said, that's no place for a Jewish boy. She said, what? You know, you're going to leave the American dream? You're not going to be a doctor?